Good morning and welcome to Sunstone. My name is Lindsay Hanson Park and I am the executive director of Sunstone. So on behalf of all the board and staff and 40 years of volunteers and community, I want to welcome you out today. Before we kick off this conference and talk about the future of faith, I just want us to pause for just a moment and reflect on the past. I want you to take a moment and reflect on the heritage and history, the shared heritage and history that we all have. And I want you to carry a word with you today as a challenge as you approach Sunstone in this conference. And the word that is coming to mind to me today is inheritance. The Book of Mormon, the LDS tradition that I grew up in, we were taught that Nephi was called to leave the land of his inheritance. And I bring this up because at Sunstone, we ask you in a way to also do the same, to leave the land of your inheritance. All of us have inherited scripts that formed us, narratives, prejudices, stereotypes, judgments, and important things too. They were understandings and narratives that helped those who came before us survive and navigate their lives. But old stories aren't law. And our parents' judgments aren't necessarily truth. So like Nephi in our collective scripture, or even the Brighamite tradition from where I come from, where people traveled from Nauvoo or Scandinavia and the islands in Europe to come to the Uinta Basin, we are asked to leave the land of our inheritance and take a step forward. And Sunstone is an opportunity to do that, to unpack the old understandings that we inherited of what our faith and legacy is. We all inherited an idea from those who came before us about where we came from, and sometimes we still confuse that with who we're supposed to be. We've never been asked to be exactly like those who came before us or to perform the traditions of our fathers. Rather, our theology can be, if we look at it this way, a call to move forward. And if we move forward to the future and look, and yet we're also looking back to our past, let's pull the good stuff from our heritage. And I really like the idea of pioneering, not as colonizers who encroach and rescue and judge us all into separation. Let's make sure we learn from our lessons. But I'm asking us rather to pioneer forward a future where all of us who have been divided by dogma and faith and rules and heritage and old ideas, and those of us who have had faith, either used it as a weapon or it's been weaponized against us, let us rather use it as a tool to help us better understand the world and ourselves. At Sunstone, you might meet people with identities who are not only foreign to you, but do something much worse. They bump up against the boundaries of where you believe your truth to reside. And I can tell you from personal experience, that's a very, very uncomfortable feeling to struggle with the disagreement and the urge of not completely wanting to be defensive or correct someone or to even preach at someone. And so Sunstone is an invitation to sit in that discomfort just a little longer, to wrestle with the roots of what's coming up for you in that discomfort and why. And so if we can all move forward to a future with the affections of the strengths of where we came from and also contend with the weaknesses and learn to hold them both in equal weight and to balance the impact, then I believe we become a wholer self. And in doing so, we can help heal our community that has been so fractured by who's in, who's out, who gets to claim this heritage, who gets to take blame and responsibility for the damage, and who gets to take the credit. Healing and wholeness come through a reconciliation of our first from ourselves, and then our collective identity. So I ask that we approach this conference with humility, which is what I understood to be a soft, teachable heart. And may we look through the eyes of our highest theology today, the highest of Mormonism, which means that everyone here is a divine being with divine potential. And I hope that as we approach the conference with so many different viewpoints, that we can see ourselves and others as our highest self. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Taylor Petrie. And we're going to talk about his session, The Future of Faith. Before we do that, I want to recognize that we are on the land that was first used by Paiute, Shoshone, and Bannock Indians who lived here and resided before my ancestors came and settled the valley. I also want to ask you to support Sunstone. We're a 501c3. We always need your donations. We always need your help. We always need your volunteering. We're a community, and we invite you to be part of that. And I want to thank Symmetry Solutions. This session is sponsored by them, and there's a little blurb about them in your binder, but they're actually tied in with Natasha Helfer Parker. So her and her organization and the therapists involved are helping sponsor this today. And I want to thank the beautiful music from our amazing, amazing pianist, Alan Eastman. He is the one that has provided all this beautiful music. And Kim McCall, who is our board member, who is sort of Alan's partner in crime and leads the music, also a very talented musician. So we're going to start with the opening song, Redeemer of Israel, accompanied by Alan Eastman. And then following Professor Peter's remarks, we'll sing the closing hymn, Press Forward Saints. I'm going to read Taylor's bio, and then we're going to sing our song and get going with it. Dr. Taylor Petrie is an associate professor of religion at Kalamazoo College. He was visiting associate professor of women's studies and sexuality and research associate in the women's studies and religion program at Harvard Divinity School in 2016 through 2017. He teaches biblical studies, gender studies, and theory and method in religious studies classes. Dr. Petrie received his degrees from Harvard Divinity School in New Testament and Early Christianity, and his undergrad in philosophy and religion from Pace University in New York City. Is that correct? Okay. Dr. Petrie has pursued two areas of study, early Christianity and Mormon studies. His research and scholarship focus on the intersection of postmodern gender studies and religion, methods of scriptural interpretation, and the impact of modernity on religion. Say that three times fast. Among his publications, he is the author of the book Resurging Parts, Early Christians on Desire, Reproduction, and Sexual Difference, and a forthcoming book, Tabernacles of Clay, Gender and Sexuality in Modern Mormonism. In addition, he is the co-editor of two forthcoming volumes, The Bible and Latter-day Saint Tradition and the Routledge Handbook of Gender Studies in Mormonism. Dr. Petrie's article, Towards a Post-Heterosexual Mormon Theology in Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, and Rethinking Mormonism's Heavenly Mother in Harvard Theological Review have received wide readership, and I definitely recommend that you check those articles out. He is also a native of Sandy and South Jordan, Utah, and he's a practicing Latter-day Saint. So we'll go on with the hymn, and then we'll turn it over to Dr. Petrie.
Good morning. So this is apparently the ward I always wanted, right? It means a little too early at 9 a.m. on a Thursday morning for my taste. But thank you all for coming. I'm honored to be here. This is actually my very first Sunstone. But it does feel a lot like coming home, partly because I grew up a mile and a quarter away, straight west from here, on the banks of the Jordan River, where I spent a lot of my teenage years playing around on the river there, hanging out at the Southtown Mall down the street here, and getting fired from the subway on 106 South down on State Street here. So don't go there. Okay. I probably deserved it, so you know. Okay. So I want to express my gratitude to Lindsay, to Grace, to Christina Rossetti, and others who helped to invite me here and to bring this conference to fruition. It really is an honor to be a part of all of this. I'm going to subject you guys to a couple of experiments this morning, and I hope that you'll indulge me in that. The first experiment starts with the MRC Institute of Hearing Research, and I'm going to just play a couple of sounds here. Okay, don't adjust your hearing aids. That was what it was supposed to be, okay? Did anybody, what did you hear? Dolphins, something? What's that? What was that? R2-D2, okay, yes. You always wonder why they can understand R2-D2, okay? Maybe we're maybe about to figure out why here. Okay, I'm going to play it one more time, and listen closely. I'm going to give you a hint that there are actually some words here, okay? Any discerning there? No? Okay, I'm going to play one more clip here, and then we'll go back to that.
She cut with her knife.
Okay. She cuts with a knife. Okay.
She cut with a knife.
Okay. She cuts with a knife. Some of you heard it, some of you didn't. Okay, we'll play it one more time.
She cut with a knife.
Now you can hear it. Some of you not quite, but most of you can now. Okay, All right? That's interesting, right? All of a sudden it becomes words to us. Weird, right? All right, let's do one other example. Now you know what to expect, that there are words there, but could you tell what any of them were? Fine. Okay, maybe. Okay. Does it sound like fine? Okay, all right.
The man's painting a sign.
Good, you saw a little bit in there. Okay, the man's painting a sign. Let's listen again. Clear as day now, right? Okay, so these come from a set of experiments called sine wave speech, where all cues of human speech are taken out, but it still sounds like something to us. But no one can discern what it means until prior knowledge is introduced. That is, you have to know what it says before you can hear it. So it's this interesting cognitive experiment that demonstrated that even something that doesn't sound, it's not recognizable as speech, can become speech when we are conditioned to understand it as such and when we know what it says. But you have to know what it says first before it becomes something that we understand. So this kind of research is a part of a larger, kind of broader philosophical question into the nature of our senses, what counts as cognition, and so on. It's not my own field of expertise by any means, but I thought it would be useful for underlining some of the points that I wanted to make today. But what the experiments demonstrated is that there is no essential feature to human language at all. And that the perception of human speech isn't dependent on anything that actually has to come from a human in some way. Okay, so we're familiar with these kinds of cognitive experiments about the limits of our perception. You're familiar, of course, with the famous quote from Yanni Thatchell Ulrich. Okay.
Laurel.
Okay. You remember this one from last year? Okay. Who heard Yanni? One, two, three, four. Okay. And who heard Laurel? Okay, most of you probably. Okay, all right, so we're familiar with this. This was a famous experiment that happened last year where half the people would hear it one way, half the people would hear it another way, and there were big debates about this. So we've become familiar with these kinds of limits on our own perception. The second experiment that I want to subject you to is talking about a set of big, broad categories. I usually work in on smaller questions, on smaller texts, but I wanted to kind of step back a little bit to think about a set of larger frameworks. The three in particular here are secularism, modernism, and fundamentalism. And I want us to think about these as frameworks. I'm not saying which is absolutely correct and which is absolutely wrong. Rather, I want us to think about them as perception filters. That is, the way that we come to interpret evidence isn't self-evident. It's actually filtered through a set of filters that we bring to the questions that we have. What counts as evidence in these three paradigms is different. What counts as authoritative is different among these three different paradigms. That's not to say that one doesn't shift from one paradigm to another. In fact, many people do shift from one to the other, back and forth in some cases as well. But like those perception exercises that we just went through, once you come to perceive something one way, it's hard not to perceive it that way again. It takes a lot of effort to re-enter into a different way of thinking about things when what counts as evidence or what counts as what we perceive is understood differently. So I'm going to offer a kind of simplistic overview of some of these things in order to help to make sense a little bit about what's going on here. And I want to tell a little bit of a story about the Enlightenment. As the story goes, or as it's usually told in the study of religion, a series of historical, philosophical, and political changes challenged the church's authority and greatly weakened the Christian faith in Europe and the American colonies in the early republic in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. So this is this big Enlightenment shift that happens. Mormonism is really born in this environment, and it's an attempt in many ways to push back against the Enlightenment, to kind of buttress against the challenges that the early skeptics and deists and so on were offering. Moroni insists that miracles still happen, that God still speaks if we listen. Joseph Smith's first vision is really a kind of rebuttal to the claim that God doesn't speak anymore. So we have this, Mormonism is kind of already a kind of rebuttal against that movement. Over the course of the 19th century, from Darwin to Nietzsche to others, gods continues to recede, especially among intellectuals. And Europe is, of course, colonizing the world during this time as well. And it starts to really relativize Christianity, to relativize this, European thinking itself. And so there's this big kind of tumult in the way that Euro-Americans began to understand and see the world. And that's what we generally call the Enlightenment. So when we then talk about secularism as one of the modes of religion that comes out of this context, is a kind of rejection of religion, rejection of belief, and so on. I'll come back to that in a second here, but I'm really not going to spend that much time on it today, often because to secularism, all religion looks like a nail, to the secularist hammer, that is. It just is all some version of deception or misunderstanding or something like that. And so I'm not going to talk about it today just because it's less interesting to me. Okay, instead I'm going to spend more time talking about modernism and fundamentalism. Depending on what field one is in, modernism often has different meanings, but generally in the study of religion it refers to a theological movement in the late 19th and early 20th centuries that attempted to reconcile the scientific progress and the philosophical changes that were happening in the Enlightenment with Christianity. That it attempted to accommodate belief in evolution, the new kind of historical discoveries that were being made, and so on, and it attempts to kind of merge these two and recover a faith that can be compatible with the Enlightenment. Fundamentalism, in contrast, tends to hold on to the tradition and believes that the tradition offered a more stable foundation for belief than and for understanding of the world than does the modern scientific paradigms that were being brought forward. Now, this can be a little bit confusing because in LDS contexts, fundamentalism often refers to the practice or the acceptance of plural marriage. And that's not what it means in a broader context, and I'm going to be using it in more of that broader context. Though LDS fundamentalism and the broader fundamentalist movement are related phenomena. Okay, so let's see. That's enough on that one. Okay, so in the classical account of modernism versus fundamentalism, the two that I want to focus on a little bit more this morning, the Scopes trial is the kind of paradigmatic example of that. You probably remember this from middle school history, if not from later on. But this is a famous trial in 1925 over the question of evolution being taught in public schools. Tennessee had made it unlawful to teach evolution. And there is literally a trial challenging this case. And so you see this kind of a time period where these things are being debated really heavily in the public square. The trial, as it sometimes is depicted, is a trial between secular belief in the in evolution versus a fundamentalist acceptance or rejection of evolution. But that's actually not what was going on. What was going on was a little bit more subtle. It was actually a fight between two different understandings of what Christianity should be. The modernist position was the position that was being taken by the defenders of evolution, saying that belief in God is not incompatible with evolution, and the fundamentalists were making the opposite case, right? This was actually a theological dispute that was happening internal to Christianity rather than external to Christianity or an attack on Christianity. Of course, Latter-day Saints are caught up in all of this, also in the early 20th century, and in some ways still today. I just looked up the statistics on this, and despite being a religious tradition that has no official doctrine on evolution, we are among the religious groups most likely to deny any form of evolution at all. Jehovah's Witnesses are the highest at 74%, which is pretty high, okay? Followed by Evangelicals at 57%, and Mormons are the third highest at 52% deny any form of evolution whatsoever. So we're still in some ways fighting out these battles from over 100 years ago. Okay, so for thinking about the future of faith, I want to reflect on this modernist fundamentalist split a little bit. Go back to that just briefly to kind of illustrate some of these tensions. Why do we call it fundamentalism? Where does that term come from? Well, there was a series of documents that were produced almost exactly 100 years ago in the 19-teens called The Fundamentals, A Testimony to the Truth. And these series of documents were authored by a number of different people, but they dealt with issues around attacking evolution, affirming the virgin birth and the reality of the resurrection, insisting that there was only one Isaiah as opposed to the testimony that many modern biblical scholars were coming to, the conclusions that modern biblical scholars were coming to. They insisted on the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch. A lot of these were about biblical authority as the challenge that biblical studies was bringing in the early 20th century. And, of course, they said Mormonism is a heresy. Okay? So fundamentalism starts also as an anti-Mormon movement as well. Biblical inerrancy was a key tenet of fundamentalism and continues to be in some ways as well. Now, one of the things that you see in these documents is that one of the defining features of fundamentalism as it emerged 100 years ago, and I think you can still say it's a defining feature today, is that they hated modernists. They saw modernists as not only bad Christians, but maybe even worse than bad Christians as heretics. And so this kind of dispute of fundamentalism as it arises really is a rejection of modernism explicitly, rather than just a preservation of the tradition itself. It's really is a reactionary movement against modernists. Modernism, in contrast, was characterized by certain claims about history, especially those that were arising out of the biblical studies developments in the 19th and early 20th centuries, and, of course, accepted evolution and the other scientific arguments that were being put forward as well. But I want to point to one other aspect that we'll return to a few times, one other aspect of the modernist-fundamentalist divide that I've been chewing on a little bit, and it has to do with the question of divine presence. That is, how present is God in the world, in the universe, in our lives, in some ways? Bob Orsi, one of the really most important scholars of religion today, and if you're not familiar with him, you will start to see his name all over the place because he's a really famous guy. And also Mormons love Bob Orsi, by the way. They're always talking about him and interviewing him and reading his books. So you'll see his name all the time if you're not familiar with him. But his most recent book, The History of Presence, tells a really interesting story about modernity along the lines that I've been talking a little bit about. But he makes the argument that the idea of divine presence really becomes an anachronism in modernity. That is, modernity, one of its essential features is actually divine absence. That a more absent God is a characteristic of modernity itself. And he traces this back to an early dispute between Protestants and Catholics. And you may remember that there was blood in the streets over this question at some point. Was the Eucharist, or what we would call the sacrament in the LDS tradition, a symbol of God's presence? Or was it actually God present there? Right? And the Protestants said it's a symbol, and the Catholics said it's not. And the Protestants labeled the Catholics as anti-modern. And he traces this back to this debate between Catholics and Protestants over the nature of the Eucharist as the sort of origins metaphor for all of modernity as the question of divine absence. And the degree to which you believe in divine absence, then, is the degree to which you are a more modern person. And the degree to which you believe in divine presence is the degree to which you are not a modern person. And this conflict, then, over divine presence is one that comes up over and over again. And I wanted to read a quote from one of my favorite biblical scholars, a guy named Stephen Moore, who tells this story of his own sort of confrontation with biblical studies. He's now a professor of New Testament, so he tells this story. I did not have the stomach for a full dissection of the New Testament for beginning students, even if I had the skill. From what they tell me, and more especially from what they write, I know that some of them are joined at the hip to Jesus, just as I myself once was, permanently in his presence, in his gaze, in intimate proximity to him, and carrying on an unceasing internal conversation with him. That may be something that some of us recognize either from our own past or from our present, this sort of close relationship, this sense of divine presence. So close, he says, he was conjoined at the hip to Jesus. He continues, I readily confess that I killed that Jesus. I had to. Beginning in June 1976 and using a knife I found concealed in the pages of a New Testament textbook, I began to inflict cuts on him. Just nicks and scratches at first, but eventually great gashes. until he finally stopped breathing in my ear. This took a long time. He was still breathing, faintly, almost imperceptibly, 6 or 7 years after I began. Sometimes I can imagine I still hear him, even today. Again, that, well, I don't know why I'm crying. So I guess I'm a Mormon here. Okay. That story of the loss of faith is maybe also one that we recognize, that some of us might have experienced. And maybe it wasn't a New Testament textbook for us, but maybe it was a Mormon history book or something like that, right? But that sense of the loss of divine presence is one that marks that transition of faith for him. So in Mormon contexts, this conflict between modernism and fundamentalism has played itself out in a number of different ways, and I think it's a useful lens for understanding 20th century Mormon history. Now, this list that I put together here of kind of the figures on either side of this list, and we could complicate this, I want to acknowledge is a very male list. But I'd note that gender is actually deeply intertwined with some of these questions as well. And I hope that it is more representative of the way that it's been happening as a male conversation rather than my own biases, but maybe not. Okay. So in 1911, there's a famous controversy over the teaching of evolution at BYU it's been told a number of different times again and again. That's a good example of all of this. But I want to turn to a couple of different figures here that come out of the 1930s and really are active up through the 1960s as well, Heber Snell and Sidney B. Sperry. And I'm drawn to these two figures for a couple of reasons. First of all, they are a part of the first wave of LDS students to go off to study at Divinity School, which is what I also did as well. In my understanding of this, I think I'm correct that there's a first generation that goes off in the 1930s, and they're actually sponsored by the church. The church sends about a dozen or so young men to study at Chicago Divinity School, which was one of the top divinity schools, and it still is, of course. The second wave happens in the 1970s of Latter-day Saints. Now, they are not sponsored by the church to go off and study, but there's a kind of resurging interest that happens there. And Sunstone comes out of that wave in some respects. Many of the founders of Sunstone were people who went off to study at divinity schools in the 1970s. My wave is what I think is the third wave is going on from the late 90s, early 2000s. There was a group of young Latter-day Saints who went off to study at Divinity School and are now working in the field. And we're sort of the underachievers. We haven't really done much. So, you know, we'll see what happens. Okay. But the University of Chicago's Divinity School was a liberal school at the time, and that's the reason that Mormons were allowed in, because, of course, the fundamentalist schools did not accept Mormons and would not accept Mormons, but the more ecumenical and open and progressive Protestants would accept Mormons to come and study. So that's how they ended up there. And they were these Latter-day Saints were tasked to go off and learn these things and then to bring back the knowledge that they had to teach at the church's educational system, the early CES, and at BYU and so forth, and to bring this knowledge from these great schools back to Latter-day Saints here. It had, of course, different students had different reactions to it. One of the students there, T. Edgar Lyon, wrote to his father, there are a bunch of the young Latter-day Saints who are following the modernists, and he was really decrying all of the Latter-day Saints who were becoming modernists. But others, like Russell Swenson, returned comfortably as a modernist to BYU, taught there for years, and described the great positive benefits that the Chicago movement had brought to the church's curriculum and educational institutions. Snell and Sperry kind of end up on opposite ends of all of this. Sperry wrote more than a dozen books, almost exclusively to Latter-day Saint audiences, where he sort of engaged with what we would call conservative, maybe even on the verge of fundamentalist biblical studies. He rejected the notion of multiple Isaiahs and so on. Whereas Heber Snell was a Hebrew Bible scholar, and he accepted a lot of the arguments that the biblical scholars of his day were making, and he wrote a book not exclusively for Latter-day Saints. He was the first Latter-day Saint that I'm aware of to write a book on biblical studies and publish it that was not exclusively for a Latter-day Saint audience, which was a feat that has rarely been achieved since, by the way. And he wrote this book called Ancient Israel, that Sperry really savagely critiques. In fact, in the second issue ever of Dialogue in 1967, Sperry publishes a review where he chastises Snell for questioning the authority of the prophets in his evaluation of historical evidence. So we really see these two figures who both come out of this movement ending up on opposite sides of all of this. But I sympathize with these Latter-day Saints who went off to Chicago Divinity School, not because of my own experience, well, in part because of my own experience, but I think that it's something that we can, many of us have faced in various ways, whether it was through biblical studies or some other challenge that we might have experienced to our faith, that we experience that urge to maybe cut that Jesus away from our side. Armand Moss's classical sociological study tells this this conflict between modernism and fundamentalism in Mormonism in a slightly different way from a sociological lens. The Angel and the Beehive describe these two competing impulses, one representing the modernist impulse to assimilate into broader culture, and one the isolationist or fundamentalist impulse that is an attempt to sort of withdraw in some respects. And he says that all churches have to face this, have to balance these two competing impulses because society itself is always changing and churches need to sort of adapt one way. Or if they assimilate too much or if they become too isolationist, then they disappear and they have to find some balance in between. And so he characterizes the first half of the 20th century for Latter-day Saints as trending more towards the modernist end of the spectrum and then swinging back more towards fundamentalism in the second half of the 20th century, which is the era that most of us grew up in and the form of Mormonism that most of us may have come to be familiar with during that time period. But the suggestion itself that Mormonism is not univocal, that it has changed over time, that it goes back and forth, and that it will go back and forth, was an insight that he brought to the study of Mormonism that remains influential, although many people do challenge the particular historical narrative that he puts forward. If you haven't yet read Jana Reese's The Next Mormons, I highly commend it to you, but it is really the worthy successor to Armand Moss's Angel in the Beehive that charts a new sociological overview of what Mormonism is all about these days and where people are going and what the tensions are among Latter-day Saints. Now, I'm just going to look at one small sample here, but I want to use it to illustrate this broader tension between modernism and fundamentalism that I think is still with us. I took a look at just the top 10 reasons. She gives as many as 30 reasons why many Latter-day Saints report leaving the church. I'm just going to look at the top 10, and then really more just a handful of those top 10, half of those top 10. If you look at those top 10, about half of them deal with what I would call personal issues. People self-report the number one reason why they might leave the church is their personal values come into conflict with the church's values. Other personal issues that they list are things like feeling judged at church. Other reasons that they give are that they engaged in behaviors that the church considers sinful. Right. So these are some of the top 10 reasons that they give. But there's another set of in these top 10 that I wanted to pull out and highlight that I've put here that really illustrate this conflict between modernism and fundamentalism, at least some of the key issues that modernism fundamentalists have fought about. One is stopped believing in the one true church. This was the second highest reason that people gave for leaving the church, which modernists and fundamentalists are debating on exactly that question. They did not believe that the church would tell the truth about historical issues. LGBT issues was in there, and I would note that gender issues, also with the role of women, that these have long been issues of conflicts between modernists and fundamentalists in American Christianity. From ordination movements, for women's ordination movements in the 1920s up through the 1980s, and of course LGBT ordination and marriage movements starting in the 1970s up till today that are literally causing churches to break apart and split even as we speak, right? So these conflicts are not only ones that we're dealing with, but all other churches are dealing with these as well. And, of course, the historicity of the Book of Mormon and Book of Abraham in the top ten reasons as well, and the historicity of Scripture being one of those long-standing fundamentalist-modernist debates. So one of the reasons that we might, or one of the things that we might reflect on here is why is it that Latter-day Saints leave the church over these issues rather than accept a more modernist faith? Why have the modernists not been more successful among Latter-day Saints as sort of providing a viable alternative to just leaving? Well, there are a couple of theories that we might explore, and I don't know which one is right. I'm just going to tell you the different theories that I could come up with. Okay. One is an institutional or cultural explanation. That is, that there is a strong institutional center of the church that controls the official publications of the church, and that it presents one particular narrative that trends toward the more fundamentalist side of things, and therefore people simply aren't exposed to the modernist faith tradition. You have to dig a little bit deep to find out who Sterling McMurrin and Eugene England are, and then if you don't know who they are, then you're not aware that there is a modernist tradition in Mormonism. And so when you reject fundamentalism, you simply reject the tradition altogether. So that may be one example, one explanation. Another problem is that, a result of that, of course, people simply aren't taught it in seminary or at BYU or others. They just don't know that it exists. Okay. We might also say maybe the modernist arguments aren't that good, and that people reject the modernist arguments as they're rejecting Mormonism itself. That is, maybe the Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham are a little bit, the modernist explanations for those aren't that good. And if you don't accept the fundamentalist explanation of those, then you don't accept the tradition at all. And I think we may have to contend with that issue a little bit as well. Modernist Mormons who might want to relativize the historicity of the Book of Mormon might have less tools in their toolkit for doing so than do biblical scholars who are able to accept a kind of more messy history of authorship and historicity of the texts than modernist Mormons. We may also say maybe we're asking too much of people to give up a lot while accepting a kind of moderate faith or maybe a post-belief Mormonism. You know, it's hard to be a Mormon. It's hard to live to the standards, and maybe that's another reason that people just don't find the modernist tradition all that compelling themselves. Okay. All right. We've got a few more minutes left. So I thought that I would make all of this a little bit more complicated, but in a really superficial way. Okay. So indulge me a little bit to talk about this other trend here of postmodernism. That is, the tradition which comes to reject many of the claims of the Enlightenment, or at least is critical in some ways of the Enlightenment. Okay, what in the heck is postmodernism? It's a term we hear, it's often used as an insult, okay? We don't know what it means, okay? And part of the reason we don't know what it means is because there is no single definition of it. It rejects essentialist definitions in itself, and so therefore you can't even define it. Okay. I think that we can maybe say a few things about it, it rejects notions of a single objective truth, the binaries that structure many ideas about, say, race or gender or the idea of a stable self or the notion of a nation altogether, or the notion of human nature. Okay? These are all things that postmodernists spend a lot of time thinking about. And instead, they emphasize values like plurality, fragmentation, contingency, construction of human knowledge and experiences, and so on. Okay, is that clear? Everybody knows what postmodernism is now? Okay, perfect. So the categories of modernity, like religion, the self, sexuality, gender, and so on, we often take these as simply self-evident. We know exactly what we mean when we say male or female or what the self is, right? But postmodernists are really trying to complicate these ideas. And part of the reason why is that there's a kind of dual legacy to modernity. On the one hand, it gives us the modern university. It gives us iPhones. It gives us all kinds of wonderful things. The ways that we structure our knowledge and the ways that universities are organized around the psychology and sociology and economics and so on, these all emerge out of Enlightenment thinking. On the other hand, if you trace back the histories of a lot of these disciplines, they have somewhat ugly, if not complicated, histories. Modern progressive positions 100 years ago were things like racial science, eugenics, the psychological cure for homosexuality, which many of these, not to say that they don't exist anymore, they still exist. We're still living with these, but these were the parts of why psychology was invented, right? These are why economics were invented, and they often had these kind of really ugly pasts. So postmodernists are trying to explore and uncover some of these aspects of modernity that we might want to be critical of, as opposed to simply accepting as this wonderful bestowal of rationality that we think that we got. Okay, so what does this look like in Mormonism? How has postmodernism affected Mormon thinking? Well, not too much, we might say, okay? It's not a particularly a long bibliography here, though this is certainly not exclusive, all right? I would also note that this is another very male bibliography that I've put up here, but I would commend to you the works by Rosalind Welch, and keep an eye out for Kim Berkey as well, who I think are going to have a lot to say about this. So what's the story here? I put these four pieces together because they're really in a conversation with one another, and so I thought that they would be useful to tell this story. But the first article is by Massimo Intervigne, The Book of Mormon Wars, A Non-Mormon Perspective, that came out in 1996. Intervigne is a non-Mormon scholar, and he observes something that he takes to be kind of curious. He says, there's something going on between the secularists and the Mormon apologists that I find interesting. The secularists are adopting all of these kind of old-fashioned Enlightenment paradigms for history, and the apologists are adopting all of these postmodern kind of cutting-edge theories of knowledge and of truth and of history and so on. He says, that's kind of weird. You wouldn't expect that the postmodern position is being taken by the Mormons, and the critics of Mormonism and the defenders of a kind of people who are arguing from a new Mormon history perspective and the kind of old-fashioned historical arguments that they were using were not quite as cutting edge. So he says there's something curious about that. What John Charles Duffy points out a little more than a decade later in his article is he situates this conservative appropriation of postmodernism in a broader a movement that was happening among conservative Christians during the time period. One of the most important figures is a guy named George Marsden, who grew up himself in a fundamentalist context. He leaves it at a certain point. But he finds in postmodernism a way to challenge the secular academy for not taking Christian fundamentalism seriously. He says, you guys have all these highfalutin values about tolerance and so on, but you really just look down and care for the marginalized and care for the oppressed, but you look down on fundamentalist Christians and you don't take them seriously as a marginalized people. And he really challenges the academy to re-evaluate its understanding of fundamentalism. And so Duffy kind of places the Mormon appropriation of postmodern thinking to kind of create space for themselves in the academy as a part of a broader movement that conservative Christians were engaging during that time period. Duffy is really skeptical of this appropriation. He calls it, I think, an appropriation and an opportunist use of postmodernism. And he says the conservative Mormon thinkers are not really consistent in their use of postmodernism. Taking it only so far, but if you actually read what the postmodernists are doing, they wouldn't agree with the way that the Mormon apologists are using it. So he says he identifies it as a kind of misappropriation or misuse of postmodernity. But he says, I think Duffy's article makes another really interesting move here. He suggests that there are two aspects of what postmodernism is all about. One is a claim about knowledge and a claim about the nature of the world, and that's the way that the Mormon apologists were trying to use it. And he says, on the other hand, there's another aspect of postmodernity, which is an ethical critique of modernism and a particular concern for the marginalized. And he says, though Mormonism might not be compatible with postmodern ontology or postmodern epistemology, it might be compatible with postmodern ethics because, as a broadly Christian tradition, it's concerned for the marginalized. Okay? And there may be some way of linking those two together. Okay, Joseph Spencer is responding to Duffy, and he makes a kind of characteristically interesting argument. He says Duffy has it exactly backwards. Mormonism is absolutely compatible with postmodern ethics and postmodern ontology because it is a materialist tradition. We don't believe in a separation between two different worlds, and the postmodernist perspective would allow us to have a kind of thoroughgoing materialism and so on. Okay, these are words that don't make any sense, but okay, you're following me. Okay. But he says Mormonism is not compatible with postmodern ethics. So he takes the exact opposite position of Duffy. Okay, so I come along, and I think I've got something to say about all this. So I write this article, and it's a kind of sideways into all of this around questions and debates about homosexuality in Romans chapter 1. But I think that everybody is wrong, of course. That's what scholars do. They think everybody else is wrong. I say that the idea of being able to separate postmodern ethics and postmodern ontology is impossible. And it's because I'm a good Foucauldian. I don't think you can critique knowledge without also having an ethical critique as well, or have an ethical critique without also critiquing the forms of power that that go behind the knowledge that's created in Enlightenment thinking. Okay, so if you want to read more a little bit about that, you can do all of that. All right, now there to conclude, I want to focus on two problems that I've been wrestling with myself that I think come out of all of this: presence and protest. The challenge, I think, is in creating space for a faith and faithfulness to a tradition and teachings and leaders that can also be critical, both critical of the Enlightenment paradigms, which would exclude faith, and critical of the tradition itself. And the reasons why I focus on presence and protest here is because they both have to do with listening. Listening to voices that we might not otherwise hear, voices that we might not even recognize as human in the most extreme circumstances. Now, Mormonism is a religion of presence, or at least has been closely associated with a strong sense of divine presence. And I would note that this is a contested issue in contemporary Mormonism, which is why we're seeing some splinter groups emphasizing a divine presence, and see the main branch of the LDS Church as not emphasizing presence enough. So the Snufferites is an example where presence is the contested issue in contemporary Mormonism. But I want to focus on three different books, one I've mentioned already, but three different books that I think that help to illustrate this issue for me. One is by a scholar of American religion, Lee Schmidt, called Hearing Things. And he argues that the relationship between modernity and the senses is one where hearing transforms in modernity. And we stopped hearing things that our ancestors heard clear as day. They used to hear voices. They regularly reported hearing God and angels and so on. And then in modernity, we stopped. Okay? And he says this is that our senses are conditioned by prior knowledge, as we discussed. Right? Another is Bob Orsi's book, History and Presence, that I already mentioned, where he's trying to trace this tradition of the continuation of divine presence in modern Catholic experience as a rejection of modernist trends in that tradition as well. And the final book is by Amy Hollywood called Acute Melancholia, which theorizes these issues of presence and absence and modernity and asks a really provocative question that I've been wrestling with. What might it look like if we were to entertain the notion that what others encounter as real might also be true, not just for them and not just solely as a force generated by acts of the human imagination? I want to ask whether the methods others use to determine what is real and what is true might challenge the ontological and epistemological presuppositions of modern history, themselves grounded in central presuppositions of modern Western philosophy. So, what she's suggesting here is really quite radical, and I'm not totally sure I'm on board with all of it, but that we really challenge, that we listen to the people who are hearing the voices of the divine and take seriously what they have to say. Now, notably, Bob Orsi and Amy Hollywood are not fundamentalists or coming out of a fundamentalist tradition as George Marsden was. These are contemporary Catholics who are making the claim that their tradition, the Catholic tradition, was written out of modernity because of this presence-absence dichotomy that modernism focused on. Okay, now the second question that I've been thinking about and wrestling with is this broader challenge to modernity, what this broader challenge to modernity might mean. And it has to do with the question of protest. If we take seriously divine presence, where is there room for critique? Don't we concede too much by granting divine presence as an ontological or epistemological possibility? And I think that this gets to a little bit more complicated issue around religion, that many people accept the idea of religion as being authoritarian, as being constraining, as being uncritical or ideological. And that in order to be critical, one needs to stand outside of the tradition and against those authoritative tendencies. But I think that this is an what's the right word? An imperfect way of thinking about religion. As we've seen, the modernist tradition has always existed in Mormonism. Mormonism is not a univocal tradition. We have many splinter groups within Mormonism. I think that we might understand these splinter groups and these different traditions as all protests within the tradition itself. So what if we think of religion not as a source of backwardness or as authority, but actually as a place where we might stand to be critical, not only of the tradition, but of modernity itself? Part of the ethical perspective, I think, then, is listening closely to those voices which are marginalized. What is it that they are trying to say, and how can we empathetically hear and listen? The Book of Mormon calls us to listen to voices from the dust. Sometimes this dust might have something to say, and maybe our tradition has something to say to resolve some of the problems, the intellectual problems and social problems that we might face. We should listen to things, not only to the words that are being said, but also the silences as well. What is there? Does Mormonism have something to say about modernity and postmodernity? The future of our faith may depend on it. My hope is that the answer is yes. And whether you hear Yanny or Laurel or presence or absence, a part of what the future of our faith must contend with is hearing. Hearing others, fundamentalists, modernists, secularists, and postmodernists. Thank you.
That was remarkably well-suited for this crowd. Thank you. Okay, we have time for probably one, maybe two questions. So if we want someone who feels really passionate about their question to come up to the microphone, we can do that, and then we'll sing our hymn. Now I've just intimidated everybody. Don't ask questions. Ask questions. Does anyone...
I don't know about really passionate, but I was thinking of the recent things that we've heard in the LDS tradition about freedom of religion, and regardless of my personal opinion on that, when you look at the four articles that you cited and the varying viewpoints on that, how does that fit into that? Because it strikes me that some of that business about fundamentalism being a minority opinion and protecting it might have something to do with with the evolution of the freedom of religion argument in the LDS Church. Mm-hmm. Could you comment on that, please?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's probably one that I don't have a great answer to, okay? Oh, sorry, the mic again. Okay, yeah. So I probably don't have a great answer to that question. And I'd have to think a little bit about how the sort of postmodern is related to that. I do think that there is a kind of broadly... In the broad sense of the old-fashioned sense of the term, liberal values about religion that come out of modernity. This idea that I'm going to do what I do, and you do what you do, and as long as we don't conflict, as long as our values don't conflict too much, then everything is fine, right? So that's where the sort of freedom of religion values come out of, and they emerge in this same context. And Mormonism has definitely leveraged those to its benefit. That was the way that it defended polygamy. Right, that was the way that it defended excluding black people from the priesthood and the temple. Right, so this freedom of religion argument has often been a kind of defense mechanism in some ways against critique. I'd have to think more about the its relationship to the postmodern issues too. Anyway, we'll maybe talk more. Okay, go ahead.
Hi. So I haven't read Jana Reese's book. I've heard some interviews with her, and she's talked a lot about that group, the nuns, where they don't identify, people who don't identify as any religion. My question was if the slide you had with the bar graph of all the reasons yeah. why people leave the church. I had gone through a faith issue a couple years ago and was sort of looking for a more modern, as you were using, a more modernist faith, and it was what I found surprising was a lot of the reasons people were leaving. I was going to churches and things that had some of these things, and I was finding that they were not full of young people like me. They were empty, and they were. So I was wondering if you know if Jana Reese talks about that, or if you have a comment about that.
Well, yeah, I have a comment about it. Okay, I don't know if Jana Reese talks about it explicitly, but the modernist Christian tradition in general has been dying for a long time. And the turn away from religion among millennials is not unique to Mormons, right? It's a phenomenon that's happening all over the place. And there are lots of explanations for this, why this is happening, right? Conservatives want to say that the modernist tradition is too weak of a faith to really get people invested in some way, right? That's the conservative argument for why that's the case. I'm not sure that that's so much the case anymore, because conservative religion, which was on the rise in the second half of the 20th century, is now also on the decline, along with the modernist traditions as well. So there seems to be, you know, something else that needs to explain that. You know, of course, I think that one of the arguments, one of the reasons why, is that religion became so branded as conservative and as fundamentalist in the second half of the 20th century, and there are a lot of people who share this view, that part of the reason why people don't identify as religious anymore is because they see that as the conservatism and fundamentalism is too closely associated with the brand of religion itself. And, you know, we lived through decades and decades of a particular political movement that marshaled conservative Christianity in such a way that it kind of destroyed Christianity as a broader, more inclusive movement itself, in the United States at least. So that's one of the arguments that I'm attracted to. And, you know, I don't know how we fix that, but that may be one explanation. Anyway, thank you.
Let's give him one more round of applause. Thank you, Dr. Peter. So we're going to sing the closing hymn that you have a copy of, and then I just ask that everyone try to get out of here as quickly as possible. They're going to be closing our air walls, and I don't want anyone to get killed on my watch.